Well, it's a delight to be here, and a real honor to share some of my interpretations of the Kuyperian or Neo-Calvinist tradition. I say so as a person who has also been influenced by that significantly, but actually one of my favorite theologians is Bonhoeffer. So, what can I say? I've been busy with oil sands research for the last 5 years, trying to culturally interpret what is going on there. And this is a great break from that research. So thank you very much, David. We're familiar with the uprisings and popular protests that have been occurring in the Middle East. And a number of scholars on the fringes are asking the question, are Islam and democracy compatible in reaction to that? And the same question can be asked of all religious traditions around the world. Hinduism, Confucianism, Buddhism, non-Roman Catholic religions in the global south, evangelicalism, Pentecostalism, are they in principle able to sustain support for constitutional democracy? Can they within their spiritual resources produce and justify support for a constitutional democracy? I can't answer this question for other faith traditions. And so what I'm speaking on is my own tradition, the Neo-Calvinist tradition, and how it tangled with that question. And it's a particularly challenging question for Calvinists. Because Calvin is understood often to have been somewhat intolerant. And so a 16th century reformer, the Reformation movement in the European West, involved a movement to deal with what they considered to be doctrinal and practical problems in the Catholic Church, and a Reformation to try to purify it and remove it back to its original roots. And Calvin was part of that movement. And in so doing, he was highly influential and ended up supporting a particular view of the state that many have classified as intolerant and oppressive, and ended up at least semi-participating in the execution of one person as a heretic. How can that tradition produce tolerant public pluralism? Or internally, within its spiritual resources, justify that? That's what I hope to deal with. A few comments on the Neo-Calvinist movement. It began in what was a larger European revival, the Revai, that swept across various parts of Europe. And the Neo-Calvinist movement was that revival movement in the Calvinist or Reformed community in the Netherlands. So that's where it was born. So it's an evangelical revival of Calvinists. And it was in the context of the 19th century, and the movement shaped itself in response to a number of really large cultural questions of the time. So it shaped its self-image and its understanding in a struggle to deal with issues like how does a state deal with religious pluralism? Who should control the newly emerging mass schooling? Mass political parties are forming. On what principle should they be based? Who should control university education? How do we deal with the social problem and labor and poverty arising out of the Industrial Revolution? And those types of questions. So it's very important to see that it's in the middle of a struggle that this movement is born. This variation on Calvinism is created. In the Netherlands at that time, the cultural leadership essentially accepted a large portion of what I call Enlightenment beliefs and assumptions. Many of the Catholic and Calvinist leaders of the time had in some way accepted some version of that. And for the public realm, that meant one ought to argue in the public realm only on neutral, rational grounds. Public is the sphere in which we use factual and scientific arguments. Your beliefs ought to be left at home in the private realm. The public realm is secular. There was room at that time for faith communities to have their faith in public as long as they refashioned their faith beliefs in accordance with these assumptions. So it was okay to have faith in public as long as you believed sort of a rationalistic view of miracles and of revelation and scriptures, that history was progress, or that Jesus Christ was simply a good moral person, then you were, it's fine to bring faith into the public realm. Two figures stand out. One was, I have to mention, Gilliam Grun van Prinsterer in the early part of the 19th century, who shaped what he called the anti-revolutionary movement. So the French Revolution had happened in 1789, and the influence of that was reshaping Dutch public life and cultural life. And Grun said, what that's doing is essentially secularizing our country. And that might be great, but it's intolerant. Secularism is intolerant. It forces us to behave in ways that violate our deepest convictions. If we have an anti-revolutionary Christian historical approach, that's the language he used, we could shape a much more tolerant regime, he argued. So the key, he argued in his book, Unbelief and Revolution, is that we need to discern what are the spiritual currents and assumptions that are shaping the big public issues of our day. That was his really brilliant contribution. So you always have to discern what's going on and how that takes structural and cultural shape. Abraham Kuyper is the person I'm going to focus on, thus the language of Kuyperian, which some people use, or neo-Calvinist, new Calvinist movement. He took over from Grun. Grun had been in Parliament. He was an archivist for the royal family. He was a leading aristocrat, but he didn't have much mass influence. Kuyper was a whole different type of person. And I'll spell out a few elements of that in a minute. Kuyper set out to continue what Grun had done and to try to deal with the intolerance of enlightenment in the public sphere and come up with an alternative. George Herrick, who's a historian, says, the reason Kuyper today is still of more interest than most other Christian social thinkers is not only that he had interesting thoughts, but he made them work. He was not just a social thinker, but he changed Dutch society. And you can still see the imprint in the structures and patterns of Dutch society of his thoughts. He formed the first mass political party, the Anti-Revolutionary Party, which later merged with the Christian Democrat Party and recently formed the government. He served in the Second Chamber, became Prime Minister from 1901 to 1905, was active in a whole range of movements, Christian school movements, started the Free University of Amsterdam, edited a daily newspaper for 50 years. This guy is a workaholic. He had several nervous breakdowns, not a healthy situation. Did not, it was a Calvinist. That was his problem. You believe in grace, but you act like works righteousness. So he was widely involved and shaped a whole series of number of things. So his thought is rooted in the thought of John Calvin, 1509-1564. And I want to start out very quickly by looking at Calvin's political views. As part of the Reformation, Calvin followed in the wake of Martin Luther, who my colleague here will be speaking about. And his political views were not theocratic. He's often charged with being theocratic. Theocratic means the church receives revelation from God and dispenses it to the political authorities who guide society. And you don't find that in his thinking at all. The other alternative is what I call the Constantinian model, in which the Christian political ruler receives insight from God and dispenses it to the church and other elements of society. And he's not that model either. But he takes one piece of that model. Calvin believes in the parallel and harmonious government of an independent visible church along the governance of an independent state, side by side. Both governments are ordained by God, and both deserve honor, respect, and obedience. Both are independent and equal and have their own competence. Each has a completely different nature. One deals with the inner person, Calvin argues. So he has a two-sided anthropology, inner person, the outer person. The church deals with the inner person for all of life. The state deals with the outer person for all of life. And neither is supposed to tell each other ultimately what to do. Parallel governance. But in the state's duties, along with what are considered normal functions of a state, preventing the public peace from being disturbed, protecting the property and well-being of people, carrying on social intercourse, honesty and modesty amongst people, public protection. He says it must prevent idolatry. The state must prevent idolatry. Sacrilege against God's name and blasphemies against his truth. So he basically wants to enforce true religion. The state doesn't tell the church what to do, but it enforces true religion in the outer practices. If you can, I don't believe in this distinction, but in the outer practices of people. And the state may use coercion in so doing. This leads to the specter of political persecution and intolerance of minorities. This is flipped over fairly rapidly into one of the Calvinist or Reformed confessions. The Belgic Confession, written in the lowlands, Belgium, the Netherlands was one unit at that time. Gideon de Bray was thrown in prison for being a heretic by the Catholics, wrote the confession to say, I'm not a heretic, I'm a good Christian, so you shouldn't have me in prison. But he didn't dispute whether the state should throw heretics in prison. Neither does the confession. In fact, the confession says something to the effect that the state has to enforce pure religion. And it's exactly this, three centuries later, that Kuyper changes. He amends Article 36 of the Belgic Confession and says, Calvin made a grave error, this is a big mistake, and we shouldn't do this. Now I want to explore where does this come from in his thinking. The first very quick look is it okay to change basic confessional material? Is it acceptable for Kuyper to make this kind of reform? And in the Christian tradition, there's a strong historical character. Not everything's up for grabs, but it's formable. Let me read this. The Christian tradition is open to social, political, and ecclesiastical reform of teaching and practices for several reasons. First, the Christian faith and biblical scriptures are profoundly historical and contextual, given over many centuries in varying cultures and in different contexts. That's how scriptures are formed. Secondly, scriptures portray history as an unfolding plan of redemption of humanity and creation over time. Furthermore, humans live in response to God and are limited and fallible and fallen and rebellious. And so what we form and even our confessions could be wrong in principle. We always have to check them. God is pulling us to an eschaton, an end of perfection, but in that final conclusion, we need to be busy checking things out. And in the Reformed tradition, they call this Ecclesia Reformata Semper Reformanda Est, which is the Reformed Church should always be reforming. So you never be, which most Reformed churches don't take this very seriously. But it's a central doctrine. And that's what Kuyper did with this particular teaching. We made a mistake. It's wrong. Doesn't even fit with Calvin's own thinking. Okay, that's, yeah, change is okay. Second element. Is the change he proposed in principle consistent with his own convictions? That's the piece I want to deal with now. There's an intuitive paradox within this thinking. Kuyper defends the sovereignty of God. God is the creator of the universe and the last word. On the other hand, he says the public sphere should tolerate pluralism, deep confessional pluralism. How do you hold those two together? Or is he just compromising with the Enlightenment, putting a Christian glaze over it? So a number of steps to examine. First one is his notion of the sovereignty of God. He talks about this frequently, wrote a four-volume set on, called Pro Rega, for the King, for King Jesus. And the kingship of Christ is effective everywhere. Thus, you can't leave your faith behind when you go into public or private or in university or anywhere else. So he kind of argues out of what Walterstorff later calls a world formative Christianity. Your faith has something to do with everything. Thus he rejects a secular public sphere or a purely rational public sphere. Secondly, he develops this idea of confessional and philosophical plurality. Society is confessionally plural. For him, this is a descriptive statement. He looks around and says, my society is confessionally plural. Christianity is divided into several streams. Then there are secularists who don't agree with us at all. There are social democrats who do and don't believe in Christian faith, and all sorts of other elements. And he said, because society is confessionally plural, we should never enforce one view. In fact, what we have to do as Calvinists, he says, is develop a Calvinist theory that treats society as it really is. We shouldn't develop a Calvinist theory that assumes everybody is like we want them to be. We have to do justice to what actually exists. That's his starting point. But why does he say this? And he says this because of his deep conviction that Christians need to respect the freedom of religious conscience for Christians and for all people. Conscience is the core of what humans are about. At their core, they have faith. And that has to be respected. And if it's changed, it has to be changed only by persuasion, never by coercion. Thus, you have to accept society as it is, but you can persuade people to change, but you can't coerce them to change. And that's his starting point. Never coerce conscience. Why should the state coerce conscience? It has no competency to know the ultimate truth. We're all limited and we're fallible. We may make mistakes. We may misjudge. So we should never enforce coercively what we consider the right faith. And he bases this on the internal resources within Christianity. And I'll read Skillen's summary of this case. The New Testament makes clear that God sends rain and sunshine to the just and the unjust alike. And that we are supposed to be like our Father in heaven. Treat people even-handedly. Jesus' explanation in his parable of the wheat and tares makes clear, in a similar way, that wheat and tares, weeds and wheat, are to grow up together in the same field. Don't pull them out, Jesus said. Christ's disciples bear no responsibility to separate people. So you can't do that because you aren't competent. Only God can tell the difference, and you shouldn't. That responsibility belongs to God and is reserved for the end of the age. The Apostle Paul admonishes, skill and continues, believers in Rome to live at peace with everyone insofar as is in their power to do so. And those are the internal sort of biblical kinds of rationale that Kuyper uses. The third step is not confessional pluralism. That second, structural pluralism. So Kuyper says, what we see around us is that society is differentiating into quite a number of different kinds of structures. You have university structures, school structures, business structures, media structures. That's a plurality of structures. They all have their different character in God's creation. But none of them can be neutral. They all somehow take a stance in life on ultimate questions. So they serve God or they don't serve God, or they serve God in some broken mix, which is what most of our life is like. Consequently, no sphere, no one of these institutions should be allowed to dictate to the others what the truth is. The church institution should not tell the university what to do. So he called his university the Free University of Amsterdam, because the state shouldn't tell it what to do. The church shouldn't tell it what to do. The Christian scholars inside the university should together figure out what they have to do before God. So the structural pluralism gives you freedom from other structures telling you what to do. So he wants a kind of secularism in the public realm. It's a secularism from the church. The university, the political party should be free from the church, in that sense secular, but never free from accountability to God. We live in God's creation and we have to answer to God in what we do. But we don't have to answer through a structured pattern of church control. Okay? So you're free to make your own mistakes in each sphere, in each structure. So you can actually have a society in which there are multiple faith communities taking up multiple institutions. So you can have secular schools, Christian schools, Catholic schools, Muslim schools, Sikh schools. The state shouldn't tell them what to do, nor should the church tell them what to do. They have to figure out what, in all integrity, is the best way to do schooling from their tradition in schooling, Kuyper says. They need that freedom. Tolerant public pluralism. One of these spheres, one of these realms, is the political realm. So just as schools have a limited task, families have a limited task, businesses have a limited task, the state has a limited task. God calls them all to different kinds of tasks. The state has its task, and it's limited. It's not competent to know and to do everything. It's competent to do a few specific public legal things, Kuyper argues. And that capacity, that calling from God then, doesn't give it the competence and ability to judge between good and evil, between faith traditions. It judges between justice and lack of justice, between oppression and freedom, between a fair integration of institutions and an unfair integration of institutions. A situation where one institution is pushing another institution around, taking way too much power, not giving enough resources to another, but not what do you believe inside those institutions. So because it has that, he says, the government and the state should not take any stance for or against the Christian gospel, but rather the state should do its distinct public justice calling from God. Now, you're probably scratching your head. So it has a distinct calling from God, but that doesn't include omnicompetence. It's simply a public legal competence. It's called to account before God only for its task. not for all tasks, only for its behavior, not for the failures and successes of everyone else in every other sphere in society. So a Christian state, a Christian political ruler, is responsible to God for how he integrates justly society or not, but not for whether he treated justly a Christian school, a Catholic school, or an Islamic school. In fact, Kuiper argued, if a Christian government treated an Islamic school unfairly, God would judge them for that, because that's not their task. Well, how do you know the task? That's the fifth point, political knowledge. And he rejects the kind of access neutrally and rationally to knowledge, natural knowledge. Theologicus Naturalis, he doesn't fully accept that either. He doesn't accept a theocratic way of getting knowledge, you know, ask the church. He rejects the Caesaropapist or Constantinian idea, where the Christian government gives you the knowledge. He says basically in each sphere and in government, the people involved and those they consult are responsible to discern faithfully what the task is and what ought to be done. God's word, he says, works within the person's conscience, sheds light on the eternal principles of justice so they can be understood in some measure. The Bible plays an important role in this, he says. Quote, the Bible is like a pair of glasses that enables people to read once again with weakened eyes the partially obscured revelation of nature, of creation. It reveals us the ground rules, primary relationships, the principles that govern humanity's life together and the relationships to God most holy. Not information concerning all the individual parts. End of quote. So the development of political insight as Christians belongs to the laity, the bureaucrats, the politicians, and citizens together. Sixth, how does this then unfold into toleration? Well, let's return to the Belgic Confession. One of Kuiper's project was to reform the confession, get rid of it. And he did that because he said the state only has, given everything I've said in this sort of systematic viewpoint, as a consequence, four negative tasks to faith or to religion, four negative duties I can discern, he says, towards religion. First, government may not inhibit or limit the preaching of the gospel. Second, which the state church had done prior to that. Secondly, the state should neither propagate nor protect any other gospel or other religion, nor humanism or any other position. It shouldn't favor it, and it shouldn't oppress it. It should be neutral towards confessions. Third, the government should never restrict freedom of worship. And quote again, does a Jew want to oppose the Messiah of the Christians, or a Mohammedan oppose the Holy Scriptures, or a Darwinist oppose the idea of creation, or a positivist oppose the root that underlies all holiness, then they should be free to do so. Even a church of atheists should be tolerated, Kuiper argues. Fourth, the state should never coerce a person's conscience, no matter what their beliefs. And this leads to the seventh point, what I call principled public pluralism. So society is composed of a plurality of structures that may have different stances within them, but it's not just individual. It's individual and a variety of structures, and they all can participate to some degree in faith and in public life. So you might have a Catholic school, and then Kuiper concludes, then the state needs to protect individuals' conscience to exit from the Catholic school if they no longer believe. The school should not be allowed to oppress people within it that change their mind or want to exit. So freedom for each sphere and freedom for individuals to get out of spheres or to create new ones. That's kind of the package. So that's how he moves from his Calvinist convictions into what I call a tolerant public pluralism. And this tradition continues to the present, and there's a whole variety of other thinkers that have developed along this route. But I'll stop at that point.
Great.